Welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 8th of January, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at Radio Albion, because we have with us, standing in for Mr. Dennis Wise, Mr. Horace from BitChute, I guess. Horace from Patriotic Alternative and BitChute. Welcome to the show, Horace. Happy New Year. I'm sorry I messed up the introduction there, but how are you doing anyway?
Thank you, sir. Yeah, I'm doing all right. I hope the listeners will forgive me. I'm a little bit hoarse. I'll put myself on mute when I'm coughing. But yeah, thanks for having me back on. And still looking forward to seeing Dennis back in action. And I hope he's doing all right. And I'm pleased to be here in the meantime. Cheers, mate.
Well, I've enjoyed what we've been doing so far, looking at the Culture of Critique series, and we've had a look at. The first book, Separation and its Discontents, and A People That Shall Dwell Alone, the other way around. You can tell I haven't done a live show for a while. I'm certainly out of practice here, out of practice technically, and mixing my words up. But thankfully, I did write down some notes from the last podcast that we did, and I think what we were talking about was the way that society has changed and how it elevates people with Jewish strengths instead of European strengths. And after the podcast, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, yeah, we're raising up people that brag about things, people that boast and displays of ostentatiousness. And a lot of this is down to the internet, really, sadly, with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And it's all about people trying to compete with one another about what they have done. Whereas in the past, it was people would do things in silence. They we'd have this noblesse oblige, and the aristocracy were expected to give out charity. They were expected to help people, and they didn't boast about it. It wasn't, look what I've done. I've done this wonderful, great thing, and everybody should support me because of this. And Trump is a big example of this. I mean, he's always bragging about what he's done. I think in the past he never would have been able to get raised up to the situation that he's in now, where he's at the top of society. Before we had usury, that helped with this. I think that put people that really didn't deserve to be there, raised them up to the top of society. But now, over the last 100 years, where we've been promoting all these degenerate ideas, we've just got the most degenerate people that are in the positions of power. There's no more modesty. There's no more humility. It's all just about self instead of doing what you can for others. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's particularly appropriate that you cite Trump as an example, because obviously this man, whatever he said in order to get elected, he spent his whole 4 years serving Jewish interests, especially his Zionist interests. And obviously his daughter is married to, what's his name, Kushner, Jared Kushner. And Trump, with them two, went to visit the grave, I believe, of the Lubavitch Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who gets a mention in Culture of Critique. And he's one rabbi who asserted racial supremacy of Jews over all the rest of humanity in the most stark and blatant terms. He said that Jews are a different species, which I think is not proven. but yeah, I mean, Trump is a pretty Jewish goy, I would say, in loads of ways. Not only in the obvious sense that he works for Jewish interests, but yeah, in his brashness and I think in his ability to just sort of continually lie as well.
He's a good example of the Jewish evolutionary strategy, isn't it? Of marrying off the Jews, or getting their Jewish sons to marry the Gentile females in the aristocracy, and therefore getting an influence there, and also paying for the influence. And there's an example of it. And also that, you know, that's where this brashness comes from. This New York mentality, bragging about things, boasting about things. It's totally alien to the European character, the European way of of doing things. And this has all come about through this new culture that we have of radically critiquing everything that went on in the past. And this serves to benefit the Jews. And this is basically what the third and final book in Professor Kevin MacDonald's series is specifically about. And I've got a quote from him where he explains this that we'll start with. I'll just give the full title first. The Culture of Critique, An Evolutionary Analysis of Jewish Involvement in 20th Century Intellectual and Political Movements. Culture of Critique describes how Jewish intellectuals initiated and advanced a number of important intellectual and political movements during the 20th century. I argue that these movements are attempts to alter Western societies in a manner that would neutralize or end anti-Semitism and enhance the prospects for Jewish group continuity, either in an overt or in a semi-cryptic manner. Several of these Jewish movements, for example, the shift in immigration policy, favouring non-European peoples, have attempted to weaken the power of their perceived competitors, mainly the European peoples who early in the 20th century had assumed a dominant position, not only in their traditional homelands in Europe, but also in the United States, Canada, and Australia. At a theoretical level, these movements are viewed as the outcome of conflicts of interest between Jews and non-Jews in the construction of culture and in various public policy issues. Ultimately, these movements are viewed as the expression of a group evolutionary strategy by Jews in their competition for social, political, and cultural dominance with non-Jews. And that's his description of it. And he does do that in the book. I think he succeeds very well in showing that is the goal of these movements. And the Jews themselves see these movements as being there to serve their interests at the expense of the Europeans as they advance their group strategy. Of course, part of that is to criminalize what they call anti-Semitism, which is when the non-Jews identify this and try to talk about it and try to find ways that they can neutralize the effects of it. That gets cast as anti-Semitism. So in actual fact, by them doing this, rather than it ending anti-Semitism, it encourages anti-Semitism. But when they get as much power as they have today, where they can start crafting public policy and laws on things such as anti-Semitism, that's the way that they're trying to put a stop to the criticism now. Now that they actually have the amount of power they do have in society, a lot of the time they don't mind showing themselves, whereas before they would be cryptic Jews, crypto Jews, or they would have Gentiles that they would put at the front of their movements, and now they're very overt that it's Jews that are involved in this movement, like Jews for Black Lives Matter is one instance that I can think of. Another instance that I can think of where they themselves are the source of this anti-Semitism. There was recently a meme out, and it was showing a Jewish newspaper, and it was bragging about the number of Jews that have been involved in the COVID vaccination. And then the next month, there's another headline in exactly the same newspaper: anti-Semitism rising amongst COVID conspiracy theories. Well, why do they think the anti-Semitic conspiracy theory is rising? It's because they've put out this newspaper report bragging about how many Jews there were involved in the vaccines. So anti-Semitism really depends on who it is that's actually talking about it. Because if you look at what's actually being said, that there's nobody is more anti-Semitic than the Jews themselves in their own press when they're bragging about their successes. But when we talk about it, it becomes anti-Semitism. And of course, we're not talking about this because we want to encourage hostility against Jews or violence against Jews. We want to discuss this so that we can find strategies so that we can protect ourselves from it and avoid these things. And because once you know that these policies that are supposedly there to help us are in actual fact, they don't help us, they actually help others, then we have a chance of maybe actually changing these policies and getting people into power that are going to change these policies.
I think even then, there's quite a struggle because you still have to get over the obstacle of convincing white people that it's okay even to think in terms of their own interests. There's people I know, people close to me, where I can't even persuade them of that it's not unacceptable, that it's not Nazi-ish or genocidal to to put it in those hyperbolic terms, to think in terms of we are a people with our own interests. Like, a lot of white people are convinced that that alone is part of the railway back to Auschwitz or whatever, you know, back to goose-stepping and Nuremberg and all this. So it's, yeah, it's even maybe even harder than what you described. But to add to everything you said there, there's one quote that I would highlight as well, where Kevin MacDonald says, in an earlier chapter I wrote, "One may expect that as ethnic conflict continues to escalate in the United States, increasingly desperate attempts will be made to prop up the ideology of multiculturalism, with bearing in mind this was written about 20 years ago, with the erection of police state controls on non-conforming thought and behaviour. As noted above, there has been a shift from, quote, the culture of critique," his own term, "to what one might term the culture of the Holocaust, as Jews have moved from outsiders to the consummate insiders in American life. Coinciding with their status as an established elite, Jewish organizations are now in the forefront of movements to censor thought crimes." As I said, that's like 20 years ago he wrote that. And about the term the culture of the Holocaust, I mean, I think there was a good example of that yesterday, when there's this huge reaction against the storming of the Capitol building in the US. And the use of the word Nazis was so broad as to be ridiculous. I mean, there's a fat Chinese American guy called Arthur Chu who wrote a series of tweets. I think he deleted it later, probably at risk of being banned from Twitter. But just in every way, inciting and justifying violence, including murder, against what he calls Nazis. And by Nazis, he obviously just means whites who don't conform to what I think you and I would agree is basically a structure of Jewish supremacy. So Nazi is literally, and obviously by, you know, when we say Nazi, but sorry, when they say Nazi, they mean someone who can be killed, who should be killed, lest that person, you know, if that person continues to be allowed to live, then, you know, Auschwitz. So it was, you know, basically the way it works is if you want someone dead or like utterly crushed, call them a Nazi. And it's becoming, it's been ridiculous for decades, but it's broadening at an even accelerating rate, it seems to me. That so-called coup the other night was a new pretext. Obviously the funny thing about it is people like Arthur Chu are obviously not actually in the long term going to be maybe they're beneficiaries of it vis-a-vis whites for now, and then that's as far as their horizons of their intellect stretch. I don't know, but you know, it's ultimately not themselves they're helping, though they will be made servants as well.
I think as far as the making it acceptable to kill a Nazi, they seeded that with predictive programming back in the summer with a TV series that was on Amazon, I believe. It was about Nazi hunters, and it was basically, it was a mitzvah, which is a good deed, a blessed deed, to go out and kill someone who is a Nazi. And who is a Nazi? Well, it's someone who a Jew denounces as being a Nazi. And that was the upshot of it. And the whole TV series was about celebrating this. And they also played up the Holocaust and exaggerated that. And there were quite a few Jews that were critical of this, saying, "You're going to get us into trouble putting this stuff."
Yeah, it's so obnoxious. It's so in your face and horrible and aggressive. The Inglourious Basterds was another example of that. Just absolutely glorifying murdering captured German soldiers, and it was just German soldiers. It wasn't just Nazis, if I remember correctly. Obviously, but that kind of propaganda goes back to, I would say, before the Second World War. The Roosevelt years before the Second World War. Just the incitement of absolutely maniacal hatred against Germany goes all the way back to then, from the Jewish-owned media, especially the New York Times, Washington Post, The New Yorker, and all of Hollywood, and, you know, so on and so on. Warner Brothers was recruited to create anti-German propaganda during the war. And this meme has been built up since the 30s, I would say.
Yeah, there was also that Germany must die, and there was a book that was written, all the Germans must be killed.
Was that Houghton, was it?
I can't remember the name of the author. I haven't.
Germany must perish.
Germany must perish, that's it. That's the one that I'm trying to think of there. So how do we get to today where it's acceptable to just denounce somebody as a Nazi and then it's okay to do whatever you want against them, when basically that's what they mean by Nazi, is a white man, a European. That's what it means. No, nobody would have been able to say this about white people 100 years ago.
With the exception of whites who submit to Jewish supremacy. So Sheila Fogarty, who tweeted out, "Shoot them," about the people in the US Capitol building. She's a LBC presenter. She would not be called a Nazi, right, because she serves the cause of destroying white societies. But yeah, a Nazi refers to any white person who doesn't go along with anti-white hatred, basically.
And she'll know, she won't lose her job. She won't lose her job. She won't be told that she was inciting violence by saying that. No. And yet white people that just point out the inconsistencies in the election, instances of election fraud, will be cancelled and told that they're inciting violence for that. And this is all because we've had this culture of critique for the last 70 years, 80 years, ever since the war. And that's what Kevin MacDonald is documenting in this book. And he starts with explaining how the Jews see this, how they explain this. And this comes from A History of the Jews, written by Paul Johnson in 1988. He says, "For 1,500 years, Jewish society had been designed to produce intellectuals. Jewish society was geared to support them. Rich merchants married sages' daughters. Quite suddenly, around the year 1800, this ancient and highly efficient social machine for the production of intellectuals began to shift its output. Instead of pouring all its products into the closed circuit of rabbinical studies, it unleashed a significant and ever-growing proportion of them into secular life. This was an event of shattering importance in world history." I believe that also sort of coincides around about the time of the French Revolution, when the Jews were emancipated. So with the emancipation of the Jews, when they were given the civil rights of everybody else, they could then make their way into our institutions and promote their ideas in our institutions. And where they had been used to doing this with ethnic networking all through this time, living as guests in our societies, once they were in our institutions, they were able to work the same way with this ethnic networking and support one another, which we have forgotten to do. We don't support people just because they're white, but a Jew will support another Jew because they're Jewish, regardless of what their political ideology is, whether it's right or whether it's left. So this is an example that the Jews do know that this is what they have done. And, you know, Kevin MacDonald does show that, I think, in this book, that, you know, this is a conscious thing that they're doing. It's not a conspiracy, and that's a ridiculous idea, that they're meeting up and talking and deciding they're going to do this. It's just an instinctual behavior of theirs that has evolved over centuries of living in amongst a host nation. And this is the reflection of their lives is what we now see in our world around us. This is why things we think, well, that's not a good thing to promote, and that will be in Hollywood, because it Hollywood is in the main is created by them, and they're shaping our culture to reflect their culture rather than to reflect ours, as I think we'll show as we go along into this. I don't know if you want to comment on any of that.
Yeah, I'll just pick up on two things from that quickly. The first one's just about Hollywood. From what I've read in a book called How the Jews Defeated Hitler by Benjamin Ginsberg, obviously Jewish himself and by no means a self-hating Jew, he said that all the Hollywood studios were founded by Jews, every single one. Maybe one or two might have passed into Gentile ownership, but I don't imagine so. But yeah, or maybe more divided ownership. But yeah, the other thing you said, I think the question of... Well, the point about secular Jews, I think, is really important, because when I think of all the Jews who seem to me most destructive in white societies, nearly all of them seem to be secular ones. So I cited earlier the example of Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the rabbi of the Chabad Lubavitch sect. He's obviously a religious man. He, you know, I think pretty vicious and evil. Not vicious, but just pretty evil and obviously just a hateful kind of person. And his organization obviously is a Jewish supremacist organization, very blatantly so. However, I don't think of many of the evils that afflict us now as having flowed from people like him. It's mostly from secular Jews. And I think what that does sort of show something, that it's not the Jewish faith that's the problem. So when atheists will say, well, yeah, you know, people of all religions do bad things, I would say, okay, but you're not really addressing the reality of the problem. I can understand you want to do things in neat categories and stuff, but no, with the Jewish question in particular, it is an ethnic, racial question as well, and that comes from them. You know, ask them, you know, is your identity religious? Most of them will say not wholly, or in some cases not at all. Yeah, I think the ethnic element of their identity is the ever-present thing. And the Jewish revolutionary spirit, or, you know, the cultural critique of these things, you know, it would be wrong if anyone said that these things flow from the Torah and the Talmud specifically. I think it flows from a sort of a collective understanding, a sort of collective racial consciousness or ethnic or a tribal consciousness, that might be the best term, because they're not simply a race or one ethnic group, are they? But I think the question of, like, most of my focus goes to the secular Jews. And just to add to that slightly, I don't often hear Jews, even religious Jews, talking much about God, which I find really, really interesting. Have you noticed that at all?
Well, they don't. According to some interpretations of the Talmud, they view the Jews themselves, the Jewish people, as God.
Right.
And they say that God obeys them.
That seems consistent with the behaviour that flows from people influenced by the Talmud, doesn't it?
Did you say that the rabbi's name was Menachem Schneerson?
Menachem Mendel Schneerson, yeah.
Menachem.
He died in the 80s or 90s, I think.
Well, what he was saying there about Gentiles being another species and they're there to serve them, well, that comes from the Talmud, where the Jews are taught that that is what the other races are there for. They're just there to serve the Jews. And all the while the Jews were in their synagogues and they were in their separate communities, they were talking about this stuff amongst themselves and imbibing it from cradle to grave. And then once they were emancipated, then they came out into the secular world, and these intellectual Jews, that, as it says here, you know, that they were bred from the sages and the merchants, so that was the mentality they had. They were very, very clever, and at the same time, they were also very businesslike and knew had a business minds as well. Plus, they had this religious upbringing, telling them that they were better than everybody else, and everybody was just here to serve them. So then, once they come out and they're in the secular world, they succeed in the secular world, and that comes out in the secular world, and they then do rise to the top. Because they've been given that ability to, finally. All the while they were just there within their synagogues, it wasn't possible. You know, they had these prophecies, whether they were originally them or not, they had these prophecies and these beliefs that's what they're going to do, they're going to lead the world. And once they were emancipated, they were able to, you know, this mentality they still had. I don't know how many generations of these atheist Jews there actually are. I suspect that, you know, even these atheist Jews probably had this drummed into them from a very young age, that they were a special people, separate to everybody else. Do you think?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was sort of groping towards. Yeah, like that point that the secular religious, the secular or the atheist and religious distinction seems to be much less important among Jews than it is among a lot of other people. I think that, yeah, it's really a tribal consciousness that defines Jewry. So yeah, I agree. It's hard to tell. I don't know, like, how genuinely religious or atheist they are, and it doesn't really matter that much. It's being a Jew that matters most, and obviously strengthening the Jewish grip on this or that matters most. I'm sorry, go on.
I was just going to say the fact we actually have atheist Jews, that tells us that it's not a religion, doesn't it? It's an ethnicity.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And something else about Jewish ancestry that I've noticed, I was thinking about today, is that we mentioned in one of the earlier shows that we did late last year that the sort of fraying edges of Jewish society, you've got Jews who, I think probably quite very unusually in historical terms, have bred with blacks. So you've got certain famous figures like Lenny Kravitz is mixed black Jewish, Athua Hirsch from The Guardian, Linda Bellos, who was a extreme left politician in Britain, and several others. And I thought this was quite funny that, I mean, Linda Bellos is someone that I saw interviewed recently. This is quite a fringe figure, and most people wouldn't have heard of her, but I saw her in some documentary years ago, and she stayed in my mind because she's got this ferventness in her eyes. But I saw her on an interview recently, and she's someone who will just without any sort of shame whatsoever, refer to herself as black in one sentence and Jewish in the next, and meaning it really, really intently, like not I'm part Jewish, I am a Jew, and anyone who gainsays me is presumably being anti-Semitic. I thought that's really funny because most Jews obviously will not agree with her, but also won't argue with her because being an extreme left anti-white campaigner as she is, she's not someone that they want to fight.
Yeah, they're experts at being transracial, aren't they? Basically.
Yeah, that's where Rachel Dolezal got the idea from, and nobody accepted it in her case.
No, but they will in the case of people like Whoopi Goldberg. I mean, that's another one, isn't it? They want a name, Whoopi Goldberg. And that shows you the mentality. I got another quote here from Culture of Critique. And this is actually from Professor McDonald here. He says, almost one half of a sample of elite post-World War II American intellectuals was Jewish. The sample was based on the most frequent contributors to leading intellectual journals, followed by interviews in which the intellectuals voted for another intellectual they considered most influential in their thinking. Over 40% of the Jews in the sample received 6 or more votes as being most influential, compared to only 15% of non-Jews. So that gives us an idea of how many Jews there were in the intellectual fields after the war. 50% of them. And over 40% of them received 6 or more votes as being the most influential, as compared to only 15% of non-Jews. And they're only 2% of American society. So
I think this is really, really important to emphasize things like that, and even things even further back in previous few decades, because there's this tendency among what I would call the fake right or the sort of the anti-woke types now, especially in Britain, to refer to things like, you know, they use these terms like cancel culture and wokeness, and I mean political correctness, but that is actually, I think, quite a sensible term, whereas anti-woke and whereas woke culture and cancel culture are very superficial and sort of misleading terms, but there's these sort of modish terms that they use, and they always spiked online is a very, very detestable example of this. They'll always talk about what they call cancel, what they call wokeness, as having emerged in recent times. Like they'll very often talk about just like the last 5 years, maybe 10 at a stretch. They'll never go back to where these things really originated. But what is called cancel culture and woke culture, I would just say the culture of critique is a far better term and a far more well thought out one. And as you can see from what the quote you just raised, and that's one of several, Ken McDonald really has sort of worked at making a proper historical understanding of what we're talking about, of what these sort of shallow idiots refer to as woke culture. Like, Ken McDonald's a proper scholar, and he's showing that by the late 1940s, you know, the Jewish hold on intellectualism and also like on you know, the notions of intellectual prestige and prominence was nearly complete. I mean, to achieve, what was it? You said about 50% of the most influential people in a poll. Right, against around less than 3% of the population. That's already remarkable. Plus, that's just the numbers, and that doesn't account for the dynamics of nepotism and so on. So that will be a near total control. I mean, I imagine that any organization where sort of the C-suite corporate level or whatever, you know, the board level has, I would say, probably only requires 20, 25, maybe 30% of Jews to have total Jewish control, because they will work together and they'll be far more conscious of working together. So 50% in any field is going to be totally Jewish controlled, I imagine. And that's 70 years ago.
Well, and this was a broad cross-section as well. This is a broad cross-section of elite post-World War II, quote-unquote, American intellectuals. Because also after the war, and before the war in actual fact, you had a lot of Jews from Germany that came over to America. So you had the Jews that didn't want to be in Germany because their ideas were banned in Germany. They weren't allowed to propagate them anymore. So they moved over to America and took all their ideas with them. And that's where That's where the Frankfurt Institute came from. But it all starts with these university professors, and then they teach their students, and then their students go out into the various fields and they spread these ideas. And that's where, that's at the root of all of it, is at the universities. And the stage we're at now, I think, in universities, is about 95% left wing at the universities. And you just cannot be a conservative at a university anymore. Or if you are, you just have to keep completely silent about your views. Otherwise, you'll be kicked out of the university.
You could also cite, Kevin MacDonald also quotes, Anne Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh's wife. This is a very significant quote. She's obviously talking in the mid to late 1930s about her husband making public speeches where he said that, you know, the main agitators for this are the British and the Jews. And we're talking Jews who control media and so on. Also, I made a video called The Judean-German War. People can see it on my BitChute channel. That cites another, like, many examples of how, yeah, Jewish domination of opinion forming, certainly by the latter half of the 1930s, was absolutely prevalent. I mean, it was not total. Like, people like Charles Lindbergh could make their speeches. But Anne Lindbergh says, I believe it's Anne, and his wife anyway, says, she watched his speech, obviously, like, she absolutely adored her husband, but she watched his speech with dread because she knew what would follow. She was going to be ruined, and she was absolutely right. That's how certain it was that opponents of Jewish power would be destroyed by the late 1930s. So the increase in power was taking place in the preceding decades, obviously. And then you mentioned the Frankfurt School. I mean, they really epitomize, I think, the culture of critique, but also so does Franz Boas as well. And he achieved his fraud. It's completely, it's not authentically intellectual at all. It's not honest. Social anthropology was the invention of a new field to supplant the real scientifically approached field of anthropology. Social anthropology was created to destroy and replace that, to cuckoo it, from its nest. And I believe Franz Boas rose to prominence in the first and second decades of the 20th century.
Yeah,
obviously Sigmund Freud was well before the Second World War as well. So I think it's important to emphasize that in the Second World War, as I've argued in my video, is very, very important. But the problems were in place for decades before that as well.
And a lot of it was coming out in Weimar Germany, wasn't it? Max Horkheimer with his degenerate sexual institute that he had that was a forerunner.
Magnus Hirschfeld,
that was it. Sorry, Magnus, yeah. Hirschfeld. That was a forerunner of, and I've forgotten the name of the other guy, the American guy that was doing all those surveys and testing pedophilia. And Hollywood made a movie about him, making him out to be a great hero. And I've momentarily forgotten his name once again.
Wasn't John Money, was it?
No. He's a very famous guy, and he was basically the author of The Sexual Revolution in America.
Okay. It will come to me
later on. It might be Kesey.
Okay.
Or something.
Not what, Ken Kesey?
No, it's something similar to that. I'm amazed. I can't think of it.
Kersey or something. Yeah, I know what you mean. Terrible. McKinsey?
McKinsey report. It's the something report. Anyway, he brought out two books, but it was basically regurgitating stuff that had been going on in Weimar. And then there was a pause because the National Socialists came in and all these people moved over to America. And then it started up again in America. And I guess you already had ideas about it in America, but it was really taking form in Germany. But there was a pause put on it by the National Socialists, and then it took off again once it got to America. And what I've got here, I've got the first chapter in the book is called Jews and the Radical Critique of Gentile Culture. And there were various different critiques that we can go into. The first bit that I've got here is a book called The Authoritarian Personality. And Wikipedia say there is no volume published since the war in the field of social psychology that has had a greater impact on the direction of the actual empirical work being carried out in the universities today. And this book had a scale. It was called the F scale. And it went to tell people basically what fascist was at the top end, was at the F, and then at the bottom end was not being a fascist. And the ideas that they had to say that would turn somebody into a fascist, the main one was punishing children. And in Europe, it's always been spare the rod and spoil the child. You have to discipline the children when they're young, because you're not going to be able to discipline them once they get to 6 foot tall. That has to be done when they're a child. And yet this book said that children shouldn't be disciplined. And we've now got smacking is illegal in Scotland. I think it's now illegal in Wales. And we've got the massive discipline problem in our schools. And this is so essential because this attacked the family. This is attacking the very raising of our children has been turned on its head. And it started with this authoritarian personality. And their ideas behind this was, how can we prevent another fascist state from arising? How can we prevent the Gentiles from working together again and forming competition for us? So they came out with this book that attacks the family life right at the very root there. Because we've also got feminism that attacks the family life as well. Homosexuality does. But this one was on the way that children were raised, and then and of course the single parent families that we've had since then as well. But this is a very important book. It's still important today, according to Wikipedia.
McDonald cites passages and how the whole thing, how that whole so-called study and book were put together. And it's just, as you would expect, it's absolutely risible. It's by no means is it in any sort of honest experiment whatsoever. This is one of the things, one of the big differences between like European and, well, Athenian and Jerusalemite culture, you could say, is that typically, when I think of like Western culture, I think of people, Western thinking, you start with a premise, you have a logical reasoning, you arrive at a conclusion that reasoning generates. It's not really a matter of choice. You actually sort of, submit yourself to logic. And I think that's a good thing. With something like the authoritarian personality, it's obviously just, and this applies to millions of things now, it's obviously there's just a conclusion which you're going to... They know what conclusion they want to reach, so they just do whatever reaches that conclusion. So their premise they present as a conclusion, and they know that presenting something as logical, presenting it as a study, will convince white people. But obviously about smacking children, it's not like Jewish parents don't discipline their children. So this was purely aimed at whites. It wasn't aimed at getting families to stop disciplining their children. It was aimed at getting white people to stop disciplining their children. And just to fill in the picture, the authors of that book, I think it was Horkheimer, but the other one was Theodore Adorno, who was Jewish, member of the Frankfurt School. And that was part of a series of so-called studies, again, all in the method that I described, just, pretextual arguments for a preset conclusion. They were all commissioned and I think published by the American Jewish Committee. So it was, it's presented as this scientific study. It's nothing of the sort. It's just ethnic activism to demonize whites and get them to turn against their own culture.
Yeah, think of as many ways as we can to try and persuade them not to smack their children, and then they won't be able to discipline them. They won't understand hierarchy. They won't understand authority. They won't be able to organize, and we'll be able to rise to the top. And it is a competition that we're in. And as whites, we've just completely forgotten we're in a competition. I was like it myself. I know most of my white brothers are the same. We've just forgotten that we're actually in this competition. Our minds are full of sport competitions or, trying to do well at work. But we've got this racial competition that we're in. And we're on the losing end of it at the moment, and we shouldn't be, because, we've got the numbers, we've got the IQ, we've got the creative know-how. We were always on top before, but, once we emancipated our competitors and allowed them to have control over particularly the media and allowed them to become university professors, because don't forget that the church banned them from having civil positions, so they couldn't do anything like this. For hundreds of years, they couldn't do anything like this because the church had actually banned them from being in these positions, because they knew that is what they were going to do. They understood that. And we've just forgotten all of this.
I think it's significant that almost every instance where Jews were, like, I mean, when I think of the emancipation, I think of Napoleon, obviously, and other instances where Jews were basically given a position within Gentile societies, it's almost in every case, maybe literally every case, it's purely for the benefit of the rulers, not for the, you know, not for the ordinary people of the society. So in that sense, it actually also fits in with what you could call class conflict. Which I think is a really, really interesting theme. But yeah, just on the question of, you know, if whites are going to survive, let alone achieve anything, again, you know, in from this terrible position that we're in now, it's you know, it seems like quite a difficult task to convince people that, you know, we have to see this as a competition, because that's what it is, and you have to sort of, you know, treat it as a competition and engage with it in that way. I do find that when you put that to people, I mean, you know, it helps to have read MacDonald's work or to have versed yourself, you know, fairly well in some of the texts, like just for your own sort of intellectual development. I'm saying this to the listeners, not you, just but to anyone who, you know, who has only sort of heard of this book but not read it, I would say do read this. Like, it's really, really good for you. You know, it's really educational. I learned a great deal from it. What I would say is that when I put that to people who I think might not be receptive to it, they seem to consider it a really interesting idea, and they do actually seem to start adjusting their thinking to it. So I do think it's something that you can just bring up. And I do mean to just normies as well, because what I've found is that, I'm perhaps straying from the topic a bit here, but awareness of the JQ is very, very, very widespread at some level. Most people will not permit themselves to talk a great deal about Jewish power and so on. But most people are aware that there's something to think about there. There's something to be curious about or investigate. And almost everyone is aware that they're prohibited from doing so, penalized for doing so. And that is, for me, a source of optimism. There's a grip on us, on our thinking, collectively and for a lot of us, even individually, in our own minds, in our own bedrooms or whatever. A lot of people still won't allow themselves to think freely. However, that grip is tenuous. It can be loosened in a moment, I think. Reading books like this helps. Just talking freely helps. And I guess I'm just sort of thanking MacDonald for his contribution to that. Andrew Joyce as well, great, great scholar in the same vein.
Yeah, fantastic stuff, Andrew Joyce. While you were talking there, I just remembered the name. Is it the Kenzie Report? Is what I was trying to think of.
Kenzie. Sorry, yeah. I was coughing.
Kenzie Report, and the other guy that was involved was Wilhelm Reich.
Oh, right. So he was part. Yeah, he was at least closely associated with the Frankfurt School. And his contribution was to put it in one sentence, I think, like, people, his pretext for dissolving Western civilization was that we're not having something to do with orgasms. Is that the sort of less than desirable number of orgasms Western people are having is why they're fascists or something like that. So yeah, basically get them to have more sex, i.e. ideally with loads of people, regardless of, you know, their family and so on. That will help us not become fascists and therefore not be a danger to the Jews. That was his great insight. And also, I think he was regarded as a bit wacky even by the rest of the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, it's his ideas that influenced this Alfred Kinsey. And another one of his ideas was that the more people masturbated, the less they prayed and the less they were interested in God. And they introduced this into convents and caused the convents to collapse. I mean, E. Michael Jones has written about that. And that basically illustrates how this idea really started in the degenerate ideas in Weimar Germany with the Sex Institute there, and then made its way into America with the Frankfurt Institute, and then on into Kinsey, who then made this report that then started up the sexual revolution, which gave rise to all these single parent families and all the abortion that went on from there. All this cultural subversion that seems to revolve around the same people. The next one that I've got here, the next author is Eric Fromm, And again, this is from what Wikipedia have to say about him. Central to Fromm's worldview was his interpretation of the Talmud and Hasidism, which he used for secular interpretations of Jewish scriptural ideals. So even though this was a secular intellectual writing sociology books, his ideas came from the Talmud. And Wikipedia say the cornerstone of Fromm's humanistic philosophy is his interpretation of the biblical story of Adam and Eve's exile from the Garden of Eden. Drawing on his knowledge of the Talmud, Fromm extolled the virtues of humans taking independent action and using reason to establish moral values rather than adhering to authoritarian moral values. So what he's saying there is Adam and Eve were right to listen to the snake. They shouldn't have listened to God. They knew better than God. And those ideas come from the Talmud. And that's just one idea that Wikipedia have chosen to put on there. But you can imagine that all the rest of his humanistic philosophy, that's where it comes from. It comes from the Talmud. This is a very influential person. This is why our culture now reflects the Talmud, and it reflects the Jewish idea of how the world should be rather than the European idea of how the world should be. Have you heard of Eric Fromm? Do you know much about him?
I know of him as one of the Frankfurt School. I remember picking up one of his books in a bookshop once. It was called The Fear of Freedom, and I thought that sounded quite interesting at the time, but it seems to fit with what you just cited. Maybe that is a sort of a paraphrase from that very book, because I'm sure what he means by freedom, obviously, is just whatever dissolves white societies. So he's addressing the causes of why people fear doing the things that destroy their own societies. And if you can chip away at that, then you can release them into that, their fully destructive manifestation.
Freedom too.
Could I just stop? Oh, sorry, go on.
I say freedom to rather than freedom from. It freedom to do whatever you like rather than freedom from the temptation to do things you shouldn't be doing. You know, it's basically saying indulge in all your passions rather than resist the temptation to indulge those passions. So then the more you indulge your passions, it doesn't quench the passions. That's why, you know, women have gone from wearing miniskirts to now doing slut walks and running around half naked and putting silicone breasts in and injecting their lips with filler and all the rest of the silly things that they do, all trying to outdo one another. And it all boils down to giving in to these passions and manipulating people by these passions. Once they're not bridled, as it were, and they're allowed out, people can be manipulated by them because they're slaves to them. Instead of being a master of their passions, they become a slave to their passions. Once they're a slave to their passions, they can be manipulated. And we are manipulated like this. Our whole society is semi-pornographic. Everything on the television. Men are in a state of confusion and half arousal all the time. So they can be easily manipulated instead of seeing what is going on. And they're encouraged to be like that. And if you're not like that, then you're told you're a prude. You know, and younger people are told they should be experimenting sexually, and they're encouraged to be immoral at a young age, particularly with the sex education. All of this degeneracy, none of it reflects the European soul. It reflects what comes out of the Talmud and what comes out of the Frankfurt School and these people that were involved in it. I mean, even Wikipedia's description of the Frankfurt School tells us what's going on here. They say critical theory analyzes the true significance of the ruling understandings, the dominant ideology generated in bourgeois society, in order to show that the dominant ideology, that means the Gentile ideology, misrepresents how human relations occur in the real world and how capitalism justifies and legitimates the domination of people. So they're advocating for communism there. And the Frankfurt School was just after the war, where we heard earlier from Kevin MacDonald, when Europeans were in the ascendant and, you know, we had the British Empire and we were in control of all these countries throughout the world. And this idea was wanting to destroy that, basically. They were saying that it was misrepresenting how human relations actually are. And it's this ruling caste. And in actual fact, it was because they wanted to be the ruling caste and remake the world in their image instead of it being in our image.
Yeah, it's also quite interesting that Wikipedia, in my experience, Wikipedia it's possible to overstate how bad it is, but it is, I think, that it largely is being controlled by Antifa supporters. I mean, I know that. I've seen that myself on the edit pages. And loads of Jews. I mean, I think isn't there a division within the Israeli Defense Forces that is, I think it's called like the cyber division or something. And they, you know, it's just banks of people on computers, probably working remotely now because of COVID, but just rooms full of people on computers, just I don't know, just fighting across the internet to, you know, sort of Jewify or make pro-Jewish all the important places on the internet, be it Twitter, be it Wikipedia. And you can feel that influence on Wikipedia, especially as when certain is like occasionally someone who's like partially Jewish ancestry or something, or fully will do something really like despicable. I mean, when Jeffrey Epstein, I think, was arrested, someone within minutes edited his Jewish ancestry off his Wiki page, which only partly works because obviously the pages are cached and so on. And loads of people have seen it already and see that it's being removed. So that's potentially not even a good tactic for them. But I think, the fact that Wikipedia, even after that influence, will still admit, you know, the description you gave was that critical theory is a project of destruction, purely, right? Destruction and conquest or subversion. I mean, it is really, really plain. And obviously, the people who've written that approve of it. I mean,
it was my wording about the destruction. That was my ad-libbing there, but it does make it clear that it's...
I think that was fully justified, though, right? That is exactly what it... That is exactly what critical theory does, and that description, I think, did lay that out. It wasn't only that you added that word to it. I think you were absolutely reading it correctly, I think. And obviously that ties back to what I quoted from McDonald at the start, which is that, and he obviously said this in the early 2000s, that the cultural critique will be or is merging into a new era where there's the culture of the Holocaust, where it will be more about, you know, less about destruction, more about obedience. And again, we saw this in the last couple of days, where these people who stormed the Capitol buildings, like people were like, left, you know, people who hated them, were absolutely thrilled to be able to call them traitors. There were loads of people calling them terrorists, but they were also gleefully calling them traitors. And this word, like traitors and treason, which is a word that I use quite freely because I believe it's justified about people like Boris Johnson and so on, and all our prime ministers. It annoys me, but it's to be expected that the left and all that are starting to use it because they identify more and more, and I think in some cases absolutely, with the state. And obviously Jews do, because Jews in America are the prevalent influence and, you know, have got a large degree, a dominant degree of control of the state now. So it makes perfect sense for them to turn their enemies traitors and opposition to the state as treason. That I would say is a sign of moving on from the culture of critique to something perhaps even worse, although perhaps something more precarious perhaps as well, because it's really overt. I think it's very interesting what he said about this, the new time of the culture of the Holocaust or the culture of Jewish supremacy. I think that's very, very astute.
It's a culture of fear, isn't it? People are just, you know, terrified that they're going to say something wrong and be cancelled and lose their job and all the rest of it. And then when they see that somebody else is being picked on, they're very keen to show how much they support the regime and they will denounce that person as well. And again, we see this with what happened at the Capitol with all the Republicans lining up to condemn the Republican supporters, basically. They're members of the Republican Party. That's their supporters there that are upset at being disenfranchised. And yet they'll all line up to condemn them because they don't want to be the next ones that are going to be condemned. It's again, this goes back to something thousands of years old, fear of the Jews. I mean, this is written about in the New Testament. People didn't want to do things for fear of the Jews. And
admiration way. And being on their knees mentally to Jews as well. And I think some people are really, really dazzled by Jews as well. Like, they're really dazzled by their sort of verbal agility and so on. And they really, like, I know several people who are... In their views, they cover the range from sort of centre right to far left, and all of them speak really admiringly of Jews as a whole, like without distinction. It's just I've heard several of them saying, "I love the Jews," and it's just like they just think it's marvellous, just the whole tribe. I know one of these people that I'm referring to is purely because he loves Marvel films. and another one, it's probably because of the music that he likes, and he's just heard great music by Jews. But quite a lot of people have this. I'm talking about people who have not looked into the Jewish question very much. You know, they're aware of Jews as a distinct group, but not much beyond that. They just have an almost indiscriminately positive view of the Jews as a whole, which is quite something.
And they are formidable opponents. You know, as you say, they've got their very high verbal agility. They've got the high IQs as well. This is why
achievements, of course.
Yeah, like
they achieve a great deal.
Well, you know, we wouldn't want to have opponents that were, you know, very easy. You know, you want tough opponents so that you improve yourself. You know, this is the thing. This is the struggle that we have with them. It's about improving ourselves. That's why it gets me when people try to convert the Jews or try to change the way they do things. It's not them that have a problem. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. It's us that have the problem. We're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. We shouldn't be listening to them when they try to subvert our culture. Now, the next one that I've got here is the critique of the family structure. And there's so much that there is with that. I mean, the promotion of feminism, getting the women out to work getting the mothers out to work so that they're not there for the children. So the children are then brought up by the state instead of by the mother. And when they're brought up by the state, who is it that is the representative of the state? It's the teacher that's been taught in the universities. And what were they taught in the universities? Well, they were taught by these professors, indoctrinating them with cultural Marxism and critical theory. So that way they've got a direct route into the mind of the child who hasn't been disciplined because the parents have been told not to discipline the child, and then they'll fill the child up with all these ideas of how his parents are out of touch and he shouldn't be wanting to talk to them. He should be wanting to talk to his teacher, and maybe he might be a different gender than he actually thinks he is. And, you know, they will teach the children that the parents are in opposition to them and subvert the child. And they wouldn't be able to do that if the mothers weren't all out at work. You know, this feminism is so Jewish. It's just full of Jewesses at the top of feminism right the way through. And they don't really have it in obviously they don't have it in the Orthodox Jewish communities. You know, their women aren't going out to work. It's an idea that was seeded amongst the Gentile communities. And of course, then that also brings down the wages. You've only got half the amount of wages that are being paid because you've got double the amount of people that are there in the workforce. So, and all of this was brought about by saying that the women are being oppressed by the men somehow, when the women were being looked after. They didn't have to go out to work. They could sit at home and they could study all they wanted if they wanted to learn and educate themselves. And they had the liberty to do that. They don't anymore. They have to go out and work for a living, and both parents now have to go out and work. And the men themselves feel like, well, what's our purpose here? If we're not the provider and the protector, if the state is now the protector, and the women can go out and provide for themselves, you take away the reason for being for the men, which introduces depression, and you get a rise in suicide rates where the men don't know what their role is anymore, and the women aren't happy because they're trying to compete against men, which they can't do. So they have to have all these policies put in place to hobble the men. You have to have diversity quotas. You have to have lower standards for the women. You have to have all these laws about sexual whatever in the workplace. And women aren't happy because of this. They look much happier to me 100 years ago when their grandparents or when their parents with their children than they do today when you see them in business, especially not once you see them when they get to about 50 or 60 and they haven't got any grandchildren there for them. And then they realised that, you know, they were lied to. Feminism wasn't the, you know, the best thing that they could do with their lives. That wasn't what they were created to do. I mean, all of this goes against nature, and that ties in with E. Michael Jones and his description of it, as we've gone into before, as he looks at it as a spiritual thing and the Jews' rejection of Logos. And Logos is the order to everything, and the order is with the female being the mother and raising the children. So this is another thing that is critiqued, another essential part of our culture.
I know we only have 1 minute left. I'll just add one thing quickly there. Gloria Steinem, one of the Jewish feminists you mentioned, who was active in the 60s, 70s, she was funded by the CIA. She says this herself. She was funded by the CIA in various of her ventures. Mm-hmm. And the CIA descended from the OSS from the Second World War, which appointed loads of the Frankfurt School. So there's another link. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the state was funding Jewish radical feminists to help dissolve the family.
It's all deliberately done. That's fantastic. Well, yeah, thanks for reminding me of that, Horace. I'm glad you were keeping an eye on the time, because I just completely forgotten it, having not done a live podcast for a while. Well, thank you very much for coming on today. I hope you'll join us again to do some more on the culture of critique. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.